we should really get like .net and .me and .co.uk. .mil. That's a good one.
Oh, yeah.
TotalPartyThrillCast.gov.
Thanks, Obama. Live from the wood-paneled offices of Mundangerous & Associates LLP in New York City. I'm your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Ishan.
And welcome to episode 11 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
This week, we're talking about social contracts, the rules that govern the players at the table, not just the PCs. But first, the Morning Glory campaign makes a fateful decision. And later, our attorney will lay down the law in the Character Creation Forge.
So before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about an email that we received from our listener, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
And he sent along a very nice email. I appreciate that. But I want to kind of focus in on the question that he asked us. He said, "You two have commented several times on how you love seeing a long, detailed background on a PC. Are there any sources you draw from? And do you have a sort of outline you follow when doing it? So, Ishan, what's your approach?"
I've been at this long enough where, sad to say, character ideas sort of come to me when I'm doing other things, you know, just going on with my life or watching a TV show or, you know, a movie or reading a book or something. And I just file them away. I've got this roster of characters that I want to play, or maybe even just ideas that I want to see realized. So sometimes it's a mechanical concept. Sometimes it's a personality type. And when I get the opportunity to play a new system or get into a new campaign, I sort of shuffle through those and see what would be really fun for me to play in this campaign. And then, you know, if there's a personality type or like a backstory that I'm really into, maybe I can utilize one of those mechanical concepts as well.
Yeah, see, I have sort of a similar backlog, except I also have ADD. So
yeah, I've noticed.
I don't have a list. So usually what I end up doing is when I get pitched a new campaign that I'm going to join or whatever, I start reading about the setting or getting some information about the background. And if there's something in there that kind of piques my interest, I'll go build that. That's what I did with Morning Glory, right? The Inquisition kind of caught my eye and was interesting to me. And then I actually combined it with an idea from outside of Eberron, which is the other way I build characters, which is just take an idea from somewhere else and see how I can retrofit it into this new setting. So I modeled my Inquisitor off of the Inquisition of Warhammer 40K. So he was pretty combat focused and judgmental and overall pretty brutal, but ultimately good-hearted.
Yeah,
good-intentioned anyway.
Yeah, that's probably the operative word, intentions. I think we're both really into lore. I think one of the fun things that we enjoy is sort of leafing through source books for fluff. And especially when I get a new system, I really like looking through and just going, oh, that. I totally want to play that, right?
Yeah, half the time, I feel bad because I don't have time to read all the books that I want to now. So sometimes
have like a job?
Yeah, it's the worst. And I can't read at my job. That's really what brings me down. But sometimes I pick up a system because I know it's a good system and I want to learn that system. And I don't really care about the setting that it's packaged with. Like, for example, Feng Shui 2, it comes with a pretty cool setting, the Qi Wars. I'm probably never going to run a campaign in that. I'm totally going to just adapt it for my own purposes. So I didn't even bother to read it. So when you were reading
I read it, yeah.
Yeah, you like asked me about this different stuff, and I'm like, I don't know, dude. Like, I don't know. But the flip side is like when I pick up a 40K RPG, I love that setting. Like, I love that system, the Lexicanum, basically, right, of 40K, right? So I love reading the lore in those books. And I'm like, I flip through and read all the little short stories and like all the little Dan Abnett essays and all that stuff. Like, I think it's fascinating. Sometimes I forget I'm supposed to be reading a game book.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, Dan, that like you're talking to two guys who in their free time sometimes spend a little too much time on game setting wikis.
Yeah, well, I just name dropped the Lexicanum, so.
Yeah, and I'm basically wedded to Wikipedia.
Right.
I will say one other thing that I've been doing recently that I really like and I want to continue doing.
Are you going to say TV tropes? Say TV tropes.
No, I'm not sending anyone that direction because then they won't listen to the rest of the podcast.
Oh, right, yeah.
Although we do occasionally reference TV tropes when we're thinking of something for the Forge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that I have been sort of loosely tying all the characters that I play in every system together in some very, very loose way. So it won't even necessarily be canon. I'll play a character and I'll say, this character is the child of this other character that I played in a totally different setting or system and with like a totally different group. But for me, that helps sort of ground them in the story that I have in my head. So,
interesting. That sounds like a challenge.
Yeah. So in the Numenera game that I'm playing on Play by Post, I'm playing Primus before he became Primus is what I've got in my head.
Ah, right, interesting.
Now. Yeah. Like when he was still a man.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Primus is another name for Cube, who is our little voice of the DM that we carried around with us in the Morning Glory campaign.
Right. Your first minor artifact.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, Dan, I sent you a much longer email with a lot more detail, but hopefully that's an interesting little peek into how our minds work anyway.
Sorry.
Yeah, right. Don't stay there too long. But let's move on to our little portion of the Morning Glory campaign.
Right. So when we left the party, they were deep in an underground cavern being confronted by Belashira, the Lord of Eyes, a trapped Delkir, an aberrant overlord that was parlaying with the great old one warlock Lu. So Belashira decided that she just wanted to talk to Lu. She didn't want to talk to the rest of the party, and to get rid of them, offered to open a portal to anywhere in the world. You know, just go away. I don't really care about you, and I don't really care where you go. And this, like I said in the last episode, was sort of a reward for railroading them by having them trapped in Kyber, the Underdark of Eberron, for multiple sessions. So it would have gone anywhere they wanted it to go. I hadn't decided ahead of time, and I was just going to kind of see what they decided to do. And a decision was made.
Rather impulsively, the first person to speak up was Kallik, who shouted, "I want to go to Seer." Right. And we didn't even realize that that was a choice that had been made at the time.
Right. He said, "I want to go to Seer." She said, "Done."
And then we're like, "No, but it's too late."
Yep. There was a portal open to Seer. Yeah.
Yep.
Of course, then you decided Lu resisted the temptation from Belashira. The rest of the party didn't need to rescue Lu, but instead decided to beat the hell out of Belashira and then get out of there as Lu collapsed the entire cavern right on Belashira's head.
And I believe Lu actually collapsed at that point too.
Yes. Then someone grabbed her and the rest of you grabbed as many Kyber shards as you could and booked it for the portal.
Yeah, well, I was down 2,000 gold and it sure didn't seem like I was going to get it back anytime soon.
And lo and behold, yes, the portal dumped you, well, close to where you wanted to go. Kallik said Seer. And of course, if you're familiar with Eberron, you know that before the setting opens, the entire country of Seer is destroyed in a horrible magical catastrophe that turns it into the Mornland. But the refugees settled in a town in Breland, not too far from the border of the Mornland, called New Seer. And so the party got spat out of a portal right in New Seer.
Well, at least it was probably safe.
Yes, and it was an opportunity for me to, one, meet the letter of the request, right, if not necessarily the intent.
That's a recurring theme through the latter half of this campaign.
And then also to give Kallik an opportunity for some pretty intense confrontation with his past. So in the last few sessions, the spotlight had been on Lu dealing with her aberrant past and sort of the truth of her existence. And now we were sort of getting back on track to the greater plot. And this session focused a lot on Kallik himself and his particular personal character goal. So he met a lot of people that he had been friends with during the war who had been outside the country when it was destroyed and, you know, were trying to rebuild this life for themselves. You know, and they were trying to get back on track, like rebuild schools and have families and find new husbands or wives because their old ones had died. And of course, Kallik's wife had died, but he wasn't looking for a new one. He was one of the few who was actually out there adventuring, striving to figure out exactly what happened. And of course, in order for the table to take nearly an entire session on that kind of deep, intense role play, it requires buy-in and agreement from everyone at the table that that's something that everybody values and finds interesting, which actually brings us to our topic.
It's not good if you call out a segue, but that was a good segue. So today we're talking about social contracts. And a social contract is sort of the rules of the road for the players at the table.
Is that the thing that I post on Facebook so they can't use my private info? Is that a social contract?
Yeah, that is, but it doesn't work.
What?
Yeah, it turns out you need two parties to sign.
I'm so mad at my mom.
You should always negotiate your contracts unilaterally. It works way better for you.
I stopped talking about Facebook. I'm just mad at my mom.
Oh, okay. Well, while you sort out your deep-seated emotional issues, we'll go back to talking about social contract. So yeah, so the rules of the road for the players at the table, and that's generally the players physically at the table. How you conduct yourself as a person, not necessarily as a character. So social contracts can often be slightly different for different groups, and a big part of this is just the fact that they're usually informal. So they're unspoken, they're kind of governed by tradition, or maybe governed more by exception. So when somebody violates a social contract, you talk about it, but otherwise you just kind of assume it. But it's an important concept to make sure that everyone at the table is having fun.
That's one of the potential issues with them, right? Like everyone is sort of showing up with their own traditions that they've either had at previous groups or just from their own life experience. And most groups don't ever sit down and actually talk about it or make the expectations clear.
Yeah. So we're going to endeavor to help with that, because I think the best advice, and this is true whether you play in one group at home and, you know, you always play with the same six people, or you go play con games every weekend and you're playing with new people all the time, or whether you're playing in person or at somebody's house, at a coffee shop, at a game store, it doesn't matter. These rules, they fall on two basic ideas. First is, don't do anything that takes away from a player's fun of actually being there, and don't do anything to take away from a player's fun of actually playing the game.
Yeah, I like to think of it as do unto others as they would have you do unto them.
Right.
Yeah.
And the key here is they're both rooted in the idea that you should be aware of and concerned with the fact that everybody should be having fun, right? And in turn, everyone at the table should be trying to make sure you're having fun. And if that's the case, everything goes smoothly. The problem is people have different ideas of fun.
Right.
And different levels of emotional intelligence, if we're being honest.
We are in a hobby that sometimes puts you around people who have difficulties with those sorts of things.
Yeah, keep that in mind, right? Gaming is fortunately very accepting, and that means you get people from very diverse backgrounds and sort of different levels of emotional maturity.
Right. And even if you have people who are quite emotionally mature, if they're new to gaming, and especially tabletop gaming, you know, maybe they're coming from Warhammer miniatures or video games or something like
right.
that. Yeah. There's always new things to learn. So, you know, it's good to have other people who are patient and can teach it to you.
Right. So let's set some ground rules. These aren't necessarily the only possible ground rules or the only social contract or even the best. But
my trigger word is Philistine.
Fortunately for you, I've had too much to drink and I don't remember what that means.
Perfect. Let's move on.
So a good place to start the conversation. The first rule, treat everyone at the table with respect, and everyone's opinion is important.
Yeah, we talk a lot on this podcast about building consensus, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not the GM is always right no matter what and, you know, is a dictator. It's certainly not that the players' wishes are paramount and the GM needs to cater to everything that they want to do. And it's not even, you know, GM versus player or anything like that. It doesn't matter if you're the GM or you're the player. Everyone is focused on having fun and should be focused on everyone else having fun.
Yeah, and I mean, even outside of the game, just from a physical standpoint, being respectful of the people who are around you means respecting personal space. Like, it means have good hygiene. You know, don't use disrespectful language, especially if you're playing with children or, you know, something like that. And be careful with the way that you interact with others you know, at our table, we make fun of each other quite a bit, but I wouldn't do that when I'm sitting down at a game with four strangers at Gen Con, you know?
Yeah, and it took a while after you joined the group for everyone to sort of warm up to doing that. You know, once we realized, okay, I guess people are cool with this. All right, fine.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And of course, you're often, a lot of people are gaming in people's houses. It's very personal for that one person. And of course, then you have, you know, children, significant others who aren't part of the gaming group.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that we deal with at my place is my girlfriend is often listening in and probably trying to tune us out.
She's a saint.
Yeah, she's sweet. Oh, fiance. My fiance.
Yes, yes.
And then this also, a personal pet peeve of mine, touching my stuff. I'm all for sharing, but the grabbing the dice or grabbing the books or grabbing my pencil, something like, just ask, you know, like, you need a D20, here's a D20, but just ask.
Yeah, maybe I primed that D20, like I used up all the ones and like it's ready to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're going to blow my roll.
Right.
So on the subject of respect, rule number two, respect the GM and the host. Whether the host is a person or a place, keep in mind that they're putting in time and effort into running the game and hosting this event for you. So meet them halfway. In the case of the host, clean up after yourself. Be a good house guest, even if it's not actually a house.
I don't know. Sometimes you'll meet people who behave so much worse at the game, even if it's in public, than they would at, you know, work.
Yeah, it's people are people. The third rule. The GM's word on the rules is final, even when it's wrong.
However, a good GM should be open to critique.
Yeah, but
there needs to be an arbiter. Yes, absolutely.
The key there is that when the GM makes a ruling at the table, honor that ruling and move on. Because there's never a rule in a game, especially like a cooperative game like an RPG, that's so important that it's worth tanking a whole session over. And there's nothing so critical that you can't make it another 2 hours until you have a chance to look it up and debate it at length, right? So just wait. Take it up after the session or send an email or look it up after the fact.
Yeah, a lot of these rules are based on facilitating gameplay at the table. Because like we've talked about before, you've got a limited amount of time in your busy week. Even if your week isn't that busy, you want to get as much out of the session, the 4 to 6 hours maybe that you play each week, that you can.
Exactly.
Number four. So if you can't make it that week, tell your group as soon as you know. Because there's nothing worse than missing an entire session because last minute someone dropped out and you didn't have quorum.
And show up on time. If the game starts at 9, show up at 9. Maybe even show up at 9:45. Probably don't show up at 8.
That's an interesting thing about RPG gamers is they don't tend to show up super late. Sometimes they just show up way too early.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything else to do.
Right, exactly. I was just so excited, man.
But I did, so.
Right. Yeah, I had to clean my house for you.
Right. Or put on clothes.
Right. All right, rule number five. Minimize table chatter / stay in character and stay engaged at the table.
Of course, this doesn't mean that, you know, you can't joke around or have banter. Like, part of the reason that you're all getting together in the first place is you enjoy each other's company and you want to have a good time, but don't let it detract from the flow of the game.
Yeah, and that's the key, is every group kind of establishes their acceptable level of that, right? But I think it's important, especially if you're showing up to a new group, assume it's zero and go with the flow.
Right. I mean, we drink while we game.
Yeah.
But
so
you know,
chatter gets worse as the night goes
that's
on.
That's right.
and the kind of corollary to that, put your phone away. I understand there's emergencies and, you know, people have things that they can't get away from their phone, but check it quickly and put it away if you need to, but don't be sitting there checking Facebook or reading Twitter or whatever it is when you should be engaged with what's going on at the table. And if you're bored with what's going on the table, maybe you need to revisit the table chatter rule so that everyone else is staying on topic and the game is moving forward.
Right. If you want to get on your phone, then maybe stay engaged more and things will move more quickly.
Sure.
Yeah. And of course, it's a pet peeve of mine. I actually really don't like electronic dice rollers because they're always on people's phones. And then of course, once the phone's out, it gets used.
Exactly.
Yeah. That, and I just love rolling physical dice.
I know. That's like, that's such a satisfying sound when it hits the table, you know, I just, it's
yeah, like a random number generator. RNGesus is just not quite the same.
I don't trust it. He's not real Jesus, that's for sure.
He never saves.
That's true. Rule number 6. Pause the game for smoke, bathroom, and Twitter breaks.
Also, don't smoke.
You probably shouldn't smoke. But if someone has to get up and go, just take a break. And as an example of how every table is a little bit different, we actually don't honor this one. Usually when someone needs to get up and use the restroom or fix themselves a drink or grab some food, they just excuse themselves and go. And then when they come back, they rejoin.
We're all really quick peers.
Well, we got really good at that.
And you have a thin bathroom door.
That is one of the downsides of playing at my place. We did take smoke breaks back when we had smokers playing with us, but fortunately, everybody quit smoking.
Rule 7, provide food and drinks when it's your turn. Of course, if everyone's ordering food or bringing food, great, it's handled. But
yeah, every week is your turn then.
Bring your own food.
No, that's fine. But whatever that expectation is, honor it. A lot of gaming gathered around food.
Yeah. I mean, we used to have a liquor rotation. Now we just all reimburse.
Right.
Yeah.
Rule number 8. This is a cooperative activity. Your fun shouldn't come at someone else's expense.
I mean, we've been over this a lot. The excuse of it's what my character would do doesn't apply if the behavior is antisocial. So, you know, you have to create a character that is going to work within the boundaries of the group, both in the group of people, players at the table, and also in the group of characters. We talked about this a little bit last week. If you are playing a character who's antisocial or is antisocial in their backstory, they need to have a redemptive arc that begins very quickly in order for it to actually be fun at the table.
Yeah. And every group draws their own line on how antisocial is too antisocial. So is a rogue lying about the loot that he found acceptable? Or
I don't love it, but you know, your mileage may vary.
Yeah. Or maybe how many times can the rogue lie before it becomes a problem? Or are you allowed to play a pacifist character who just refuses to contribute in combat?
You mean a grappler?
Okay.
Or an enchanter? Illusionists are great.
What about broken characters? Because this is another problem with power gamer player types, especially with that psychographic. They like to break games. So is that acceptable?
Right. And how broken is broken? Or what's just quite powerful?
Right. Is it okay to just be a beast in combat, but then give the limelight back in other scenarios?
Right. One thing I used to like to do is if I did want to play sort of like a gruff antisocial character, there would be a reason for it in character that didn't interfere with other people's fun. Like, there was a time when I was really into tactical combat, particularly when we were playing 4th edition, and I felt myself wanting to tell other people what would be sort of a more optimal use of their action, right? But that's stupid.
The quarterbacking problem.
Yeah, exactly. However, I decided to play a warlord.
And then you literally could tell people what to do.
I was the quarterback of the team. Right. Yes, exactly. The power was literally, you move to the place I tell you to move.
Right, yeah. Right. And then attack.
Yes.
All right, so rule number 9. We touched on a little bit before, but in-game loot and XP distribution. So what are the rules around how you divvy up loot and experience points?
And this varies from system to system, but honestly, for the most part, we really think that everyone should go with an even distribution, even if someone misses a session.
Yeah, and that just keeps everybody on the same footing, and it keeps life problems from getting in the way of the game, right? This is escapism for everybody at the table. So why is the fact that I had to work late last week constantly reminded on my character sheet?
Right, the punishment was missing the game.
Right, yeah, we all want to be here. Like, I wanted to be at the game. I couldn't be at the game.
I'm okay in very sort of granular systems with awarding maybe a bit of bonus XP for doing something. But yeah, we'll see how that can get a little bit wonky at times. And that only really works when you have a system where small amounts of XP can be useful, but but don't actually have a huge effect. So 40K, for example. I mean, like in D&D, you obviously wouldn't give someone an entire level, but you know, 25 XP and 40K isn't a big deal.
Yeah, and then in terms of loot distribution, what we've done primarily is just assume that everything was split even. So if it was convertible to cash, gems, gold, etc., we just split it the number of ways, regardless of who was there or not. Just there's six party members, so it split six ways. And then when it came to actual valuable, usable loot, such as potions or magic items, well, we went from just sort of a fair assessment of need. So if it seemed like a wizard staff, it went to one of the spellcasters. You know, if it was a wonderful giant sword, probably went to the paladin. And in terms of like consumables, it was usually greatest utility for the party. Who would get the most use out of it?
And I think this was actually a good idea that was introduced in 4th edition, is the idea of wish lists for loot. It doesn't mean that players will necessarily get exactly the thing that they're looking for, but GMs in general should tailor loot drops to actually be useful.
Yeah, I mean, some people still use random loot, though. So it's, this is, again, very table specific. It depends on even the system you're playing, and just have an idea of what it is up front, because it's uncomfortable when somebody has different expectations.
Whatever system you're playing, just make sure that it's fair. One of the least fun games I was ever in was when we all played retainers to a prince, and the prince was played by one of the players. But that just meant that he got all the good stuff.
Yeah, that sucks.
It totally sucked. I dropped out after like four sessions.
Ugh, that's a long time to stick with it.
I was 17.
Oh, well, then you had nothing but time to stick with it.
Yep.
So this is actually something that I sort of ran into our own social contract with at one point during the campaign when you, I'm trying to...
The Encyclopedia Askendi?
Yeah, so It was the magic books that increase your... their artifacts or legendary items or whatever they are that permanently increased an ability score.
Right.
And so I had gotten us a set of them because I had rolled obscenely high on a persuasion check.
So it's interesting that that's your perception of it.
I rolled like a 40.
Yeah, I know. You were going to get the encyclopedia anyway.
But I rolled like a 40.
Which is why you got other magic items.
But I rolled like a 40. And so in character, we received them from dragons, and my character was a dragon sorcerer who's, you know, believed that he was somehow touched by dragons. He felt that that was a personal gift and that he should have first pick of the loot, because without his crazy high roll, we wouldn't have had it. Whether or not that was true, irrelevant. Obviously, that kind of ran counter to what we had done to that point. And I was quickly reminded that that's not how we do things. And that's totally fair. I mean, I was out of line on that one. I screwed that one up. Though I maintain, in character, still violated the social contract.
I mean, you were playing a character who's kind of a jerk.
Fair enough.
Okay. I remember that. And, you know, after the session, we all went home. We were all sort of bantering back and forth via email, trying to decide how to split up the loot. And I thought, okay, this could potentially be an issue because there's one item that three characters want and all of them could use it equally well.
Right. It was the charisma book was the problem.
Right. And you had a warlock, a sorcerer,
and a bard. Yeah.
So if you guys hadn't resolved it as quickly as you did on your own, as the GM, I would have stepped in.
As you do.
I think I would have actually done the... I would have made you roll for it, which is what you guys decided to do anyway.
Yeah. No. It worked out fine. Yeah. I mean, I was in the wrong.
We accept your apology. But you'll never live it down.
You're so gracious. And then rule number 10, the black veil. So this isn't a concept we invented, but the basic idea behind the black veil is if at any time a player is uncomfortable for any reason, all he has to do is announce it and the scene immediately fades to black. This is great for any time you have any type of erotic scene in an otherwise not erotic game. You have the seduction scene of the barmaid, for example.
Yeah, even in a game that's maybe, you know, more serious or a little bit more buttoned up, there always might be a time when someone wants to try to seduce royalty in order to, you know, make things happen. But yeah, you just fade to black.
Yeah, or torture or anything particularly gruesome or, you know, has perhaps a trigger warning kind of thing.
Yeah, it's also useful in horror games where, you know, you might want to play in Ravenloft or in a zombie type game, but some groups really don't want to like have those detailed descriptions of exactly what viscera are getting munched on.
Or anything violence or anything against children. A lot of times that can upset parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, and more important than us naming a few things, the idea here is that anything that causes an adverse emotional reaction from a player, you should be able to stop. So that's what the veil is there for.
Right. The settings that a lot of us play in are not necessarily progressive usually, but the table really should be a place where people feel comfortable because you are sort of going out on a limb and exposing a part of yourself when you're inhabiting these characters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so an important part of that too, I think, is you shouldn't have to explain why. You don't have to put that out there. All that has to be said is I'm not comfortable. End of discussion.
Right. The onus is not on the person who is uncomfortable to defend why they are.
Right. Exactly.
And in fact, there's no argument because the other people at the table can't then argue that it should be there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There's no artistic merit for anything that makes somebody uncomfortable, in my opinion. And I think that's something that every table should adopt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if someone at your table is feeling uncomfortable, why would you want to continue with it? The whole point is that everyone has fun.
Exactly. Unless everyone agrees, right, that the point of this is to somehow try to make everybody uncomfortable. Not the game I'm going to play in, but different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it varies from table to table. There was, I recall, a fairly graphic depiction of Congress between your character and an Eldar in our 40K game.
Though you may recall that I actually drew the veil on myself because I didn't want to roleplay that scene, though I did agree because we were joking and it was just that I frankly didn't want to do it. I did agree that I would provide something of equal entertainment, and thus I did provide some slight slash fic.
It was impressive. And it was not vetoed ahead of time.
Right. Yeah, I did warn everybody that that's what I was doing. So, but yes, Eldar human relations were improved for one day at least.
Right. So, of course, aside from just helping everyone feel comfortable, this also just totally removes the possibility of those horror stories that we've all heard about, you know, the terrible GM who does awful things at the very first session to random people's characters.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It shouldn't happen, but, you know, with this rule in place, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this probably affects female gamers more than male gamers. I think that trope is pretty well established of the sort of creepy GM who either pays too much attention or pays negative attention to a female player at the table.
Unfortunately, it's a trope because it still happens.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, on that note, rule number 11, and this might be actually rule zero, everyone chooses to be there. And anyone can choose to leave. So if you're not having fun, if that's not the game you want to be at, if that's not how you want to spend your time, don't. Just go. Because honestly, bad gaming is worse than no gaming.
Yeah, I see lots of times when people post in threads online about, oh, I'm having a real problem with this group. Well, a lot of the time the answer is the group is bad and you should find a new group.
Yeah, it's not the right group for you. That's okay.
Right.
And especially now, you can play so much online. Like, there's... I understand that sometimes it's more fun to play in person, but you can have great games online. Look at that.
Yeah. I've been dabbling in Play by Post as well.
I know.
I will say people take it super seriously because you never see the other players in real life. They're not real people. They're actually their characters, and that's maybe a little intense sometimes.
So you're having to adjust to a new social contract, huh?
Yeah, I'm learning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to stay open. You know, there are usually out of character threads where you can work things out. I try to be very communicative and receptive in those. So
that actually brings us to the idea of game specific social contracts, which is that sometimes you have to suspend the rules around certain games you're going to play. Play by Post, for example, is different from being in person.
Right. White Wolf is totally different from Shadowrun.
So a White Wolf game like Vampire or Werewolf, it's got a different focus than D&D. Another thing in the board game arena, Dead of Winter, for example, is a cooperative game, but there's a chance it has a traitor. Generally, there's a point in the game where the traitor can completely screw over the loyal colonists, even when it can't help him win. he knows he's already lost and he could just make everybody at the table lose. In some tables, that would be considered unsporting. Other people might not mind. So it's a good idea to talk about that.
Yeah, it's usually better to find out ahead of time than to find out after you've done it.
Yeah, especially because you put 2 or 3 hours into a game. Well, that one maybe 2 hours. And that's a lot of time to lose just to find out the guy screwed you at the end and then you don't get to figure out if you could have won.
So we mentioned this a little earlier with the allocation of XP, but Numenera in the Cypher system has this idea of GM intrusions, where something bad or negative happens, but because of that, you get XP.
The GM decides, he intrudes on the story and says, okay, there's a negative consequence for this character. As a reward, that character gets 1 XP, and that player gets to give 1 XP to another player. And I use those words specifically because the book says player gives to another player, which is confusing because everyone has different expectations. And I've literally seen it happen where people have different expectations for how that should be handed out. Some groups, it should be an in-character decision. So they should give it to their closest ally in the party, for example. Other groups, they think the person who has instigated the GM intrusion has effectively awarded one person a free XP. They should be in turn given the other XP. Other groups do it randomly. They want everyone to stay sort of in sync. So if you get one this time and you got one last time, well, then we'll give it to player three.
Right. So you can see many different possible complications from a system that's sort of written vaguely in this way. What happens when you've got players who aren't that mature and everyone just keeps giving the extra XP to the same player, you know, either to ingratiate themselves or because of an unrequited crush, or maybe they just don't like another person at the table and no one's giving them XP.
Yeah, I think being singled out is probably worse than being singled up.
Yeah.
And then you also have some games where antisocial behavior and betrayal is sort of accepted. It's par for the course, even in role-playing games. So Paranoia is the classic example, but Fiasco is sort of a more modern narrative storytelling game that you're expected, players are going to die, and players are going to turn on each other, and they're going to actively harm each other. That's fine. That's part of the game.
Right. The operative concern is what is fun, and part of the fun of those games, which, let's be honest, don't usually last very long because they're not supposed to,
right,
is that you're wondering, you're sort of looking behind your back all the time.
Right. And to be fair to all players, you should make sure that everyone understands that up front.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who's used to playing cooperative storytelling games is going to be very surprised the first time they get killed in Paranoia. and that could be unfun for them if they're not expecting it, right? And that's not a very nice introduction to a new game. So you recently had an issue. We've been playtesting Phoenix Dawn Command, and we can't speak about the specifics of it, but you did have an issue with the social contract of that game recently.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't have, you know, like a full rule book, so I had wondered if this was covered. But the general idea is that you are this spirit that has returned from death for a purpose. And death is not necessarily a setback. It's actually how you get stronger in the game.
Yeah, it's literally how you level up.
Right. So I had wondered, okay, if we're, you know, trying to save the world, then shouldn't the first thing my character does if they want to be the most successful is kill themselves and get stronger, yeah?
Right, which is a fair question, though I think sort of against the spirit. The dramatic question of Phoenix is around what sacrifice is worth it. When is the right time to sacrifice a life to get stronger?
And then, of course, in-game, you know, the explanation that we got after the question was, well, it's not always guaranteed that you come back. So, of course, that's a risk that your character would have to be taking. And then, of course, in general, it's not part of the social contract of the game.
Yeah, it's just kind of not sporting.
Right. So, you know, do it.
So, invariably, since this is such an informal system, and despite our best efforts to codify it, not everyone will listen to our top 11 list. How do we handle conflict when the social contract has been violated?
I feel like I'm in therapy again. Fine, I guess maybe we'll like talk about it, and you know, I'll like have feelings and I'll communicate them and then expect you to be receptive and then also communicate.
no, you're going to be really passive aggressive and then like you're going to storm out on me and you're not going to talk to me for 3 days.
Hey, I'm never passive. I'm just aggressive.
No, but handle it like adults. So if it's something specific to another player, take that person aside and just have a conversation with them. Right? It's usually something that player doesn't even realize bothers you, whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, even in groups that really are trying to all get along, yeah, lots of times there's just a misunderstanding and people may not even know that there's a misunderstanding.
Right.
So bring it up. Like, the main gist of this entire episode is table talk is good. Table talk is healthy. Keep things out in the open.
Yeah. And sometimes it can be a little bit of work to keep a good group going.
Oh, it's totally a lot of work. Yeah. Well,
yeah. But also a lot of, like, you know, talking.
Right. About people's feelings about and respecting feelings. The way that they feel.
And fun.
Adulthood. But okay, what if you're not adults?
That becomes more difficult because I think the social contract is much more malleable when you're a teenager.
Yeah. You know,
I think back to high school and the games that we played. We weren't emotionally mature. We weren't fully formed adults. We were insecure about things. We didn't want to talk about certain things. And being uncomfortable was sort of a weakness amongst teenage boys, right? So it can be really tough.
Yeah, I would sort of use it again as the touchstone is everyone having fun? Maybe the game basically turns into like poop jokes. But if everyone's really enjoying that, fine. But when I was in high school, the way every one of our campaigns ended was that as soon as someone hit level 7 as a wizard, they would polymorph other and now the game was over. And that sucked. But I didn't communicate that I don't enjoy all of our campaigns ending this way.
Ours usually ended with land sharks. I can't tell you how many campaigns ran for a few sessions. I was like, you're getting a boule to the face.
I was just about to ask how you pronounce it.
Yeah, I think it's boule.
It is boule.
Joking aside, if it's an interpersonal thing, take that person aside, treat them like an adult, be open-minded, and just share how you feel. If it's sort of a broader question of, is this how we handle these things? Or, you know, I had a question about how we did something, or I think a rules decision was wrong, here's why, whatever that is, I think you should take time out after the game and either discuss it in person, or if that doesn't work for whatever your setup is, send an email. Just involve the whole group and say, hey, I had a question because I felt this way. How do you guys feel about it?
Don't just tweet it to everyone.
Oh, that would be the passive aggressive part.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Maybe not a great idea. So definitely don't run to Reddit and create a nightmare thread.
Alan, who's playing a barbarian, don't read this.
Yeah.
Sorry, Alan.
Yeah, Alan, it's not your fault, man. You didn't know.
Yeah. I didn't communicate. But I did downvote you.
Right. Speaking of downvotes, do you hear that, Ishan?
Is that my karma hitting rock bottom?
It is. But it is also the sound of the Character Creation Forge. But before we get to the forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We love hearing from our listeners.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, MUN Dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast. You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com. And lastly, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com. So what are we talking about on the Forge today, Ishan?
We've got Super Shyster. That's an attorney.
An attorney of law, not an attorney at law.
Yes, indeed. So, Shane, again, like last week, we've got one build and two backstories.
Right.
Can you run us through this build?
Yeah, so this build was all about getting the skills necessary to be an attorney.
So it's just all deception.
And some persuasion.
Yeah,
and intimidation. And history. And arcana. And religion, nature, pretty much every skill in the book, actually, I think we'll end up having available to us.
I think we did get every skill.
All right, so how do we do that? Well, we took 18 levels of bard, a level of rogue, and a level of knowledge cleric. And that literally gives us 6 expertises. two of which have to be knowledge skills. So I would recommend History and Arcana, because this is a magical world after all. It's important to know the law and how magic applies to it.
Although if you're a lawyer in Boston or Italy, I would take religion.
Oh, good point. But then persuasion, deception, and intimidation. So you've got expertise, double your proficiency bonus, and a lot of useful skills. You're also going to end up with just a bunch of skills. So you should be proficient in almost everything.
Even the physical ones.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're not limited just to the, you know, talking skills. You could actually be a pretty good second story artist on your own there.
Or a grappler.
But yeah, I would recommend you take half elf specifically because of the...
Because they're the best. Because they're OP.
They're strong.
They are strong.
And they have advantage against saving throws.
Charm.
First charm, yeah. Which would be handy as a attorney. You don't want the other side of the aisle, other side of the bench. You don't want anybody convincing you, right?
Yeah.
But the key here, 18 levels of bard, that gives you a ton of super flavorful abilities. Cutting words, for example, turns your sarcasm into a flavorful distraction.
Vicious mockery.
Dissonant whispers.
Suggestion.
Isn't that a little simple?
Maybe. Do bards get Zone of Truth?
They don't.
Ugh.
But you could take it with magical secrets.
Right. Yeah. So actually, anything you want, because...
You get magical secrets, and you're a 9th level caster.
Which means... You get a wish.
So already this is the most powerful build possible.
As befits a lawyer.
Right. Yeah, because you would use every little rule in the book to your advantage. You're an attorney.
I mean, if there's any character that can properly word a wish, it should be the attorney.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll admit, I originally proposed this topic for the Forge as a joke because, you know, we knew we were talking about social contracts and lawyers and contracts, right? It's kind of a little punny. I have never heard of a lawyer as an adventurer. So we had our work cut out for us trying to figure out what are the story concepts that support a lawyer in an adventuring party.
Right, without necessarily being super anachronistic.
Right.
It could easily, but yeah, we wanted to avoid that. Or at least have options that weren't.
Sure. So
what have you got?
No, what have you got?
Oh, that's turnabout. Okay.
Yeah. Social contract. Nailed it.
So I stuck with the medieval flavor of 5e and modeled this backstory a bit off a character that I actually played in Warhammer Fantasy, which is the Judicial Champion. So in medieval times, yeah, if you were lucky, you got a trial by jury, you know, in more enlightened areas. But it was just as likely that you were actually going to have a trial by combat.
Uh-huh.
And again, if you were lucky, you could have someone else fight in your stead. And who better to do that than an 18th level bard who can cast Wish?
Yep, I wish I weren't having to fight you right now.
Or, I wish for 25,000 gold pieces. Please make this go away.
Right. Or, I wish for 25,000 gold pieces on top of my opponent's head.
Double win. So, the way I see this character playing is that they're a small town lawyer with, you know, a good heart who uses their persuasive abilities and just this vast number of skills to do all the research that's necessary and argue very convincingly in either in front of a judge or in front of a mob or in front of a jury that their client, who actually is innocent, because remember, they're also trained in insight, so they'll be able to tell if they're lying. That their client actually is innocent. And of course, if they're up against corruption or their client is being framed or whatever, they, if necessary, can throw down.
Yeah, just request that trial by combat. Spill some blood.
That's right. It's a pro bono beatdown.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a blend of Daredevil meets Michael Weston from Burn Notice almost.
If I can build a Burn Notice character for everything, I would.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we did the Navy SEAL, I was like, oh yeah, Sam Axe.
So I think we should...
Oh, and the sniper is Fiona.
No, Fiona's the demolitions expert. Jesse is a sniper.
He's also a good sniper. Well, Sam is also a good sniper. They're all good snipers.
Well,
let's talk about...
Why would you join a party?
Two things. Why would he join a party and why would a party want a lawyer?
Right.
Right. So I think, like I said, he starts out as a small town lawyer, but if Atticus Finch was an 18th level bard...
And not a racist?
He's not a racist. That book's not canon. Didn't actually happen. She has dementia.
And Dumbledore's not gay.
No, Dumbledore's totally gay. That's word of God.
That's pretty much canon.
That's word of God.
It's basically in the book.
Also, it's awesome. Atticus being a racist, not awesome. Doesn't count.
All right. So why would you join a party, and why would a party want you?
So he joins the party because he can help more people that way. After a while, you sort of outgrow this small town courthouse. Probably everyone in the town really likes you. That, or you've been run out of town, right? One of those two options.
Oh, yeah. Run out of town.
Yeah. Yeah, you defended the wrong guy. He was innocent, right?
But he didn't look innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah, unpopular but innocent.
Mm-hmm. So now you're basically a wandering attorney.
What if the other guy was a party member?
That you were trying to defend?
Yeah, you saved him. They were framed, and now you're both having it. Yeah.
That works for me, too.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Yes, either lost the case that you shouldn't have lost and now disgusted and moving on to try to help other people, or, yeah, somewhat.
Won a case that looked bad, but now you have to leave town.
Yeah, that's a really nice origin story. And then, of course, I mean, the party. Why wouldn't the party want this guy? You know, what can't he do?
It's true.
Yeah, and do really well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, particularly in, you know, those other two pillars other than combat, right? Social and exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and 18th level bard. Like, he can still hold his own in a fight as a really, really good support character. Because we're going lore, not valor.
Right.
All right, so what have you got?
So you stuck with the medieval. I went a little bit more Renaissance. And this is more of a whimsical idea, but what if there was a lawyer out there who worked with rich patrons who routinely hire adventuring parties, and he was sort of an escrow agent. So he would follow the party into the dungeon, do a little bit of work himself, take his fair share of the treasure, but ensure that the loot was distributed evenly according to the contract that the patron had drawn up.
Wow, that's remarkably modern.
I know. Almost Eberronian.
I was going to say Machiavellian, but yes, I like it. Oh, okay. Eberron?
Yeah.
Because
Eberron has the mature rule of law in enough places would make sense.
So Eberron, this bill can still work with a dwarf. So it could be House Kundaric, the banking clan.
Oh, yeah. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. I didn't even think of that.
And a dwarven bard, I mean, they wouldn't want to stay in the Morrow Worlds anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, they'd be wandering.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, Kundaric would have so many uses for an 18th level bard. You can make... Okay, once you hit level 18, they're not going to let you adventure. You're making gold.
Yeah, exactly.
In the basement.
Yeah. It's you're inflating this economy.
Right. You're locked in Gringotts.
Right. So it does have kind of a challenge, which is that if you're hired by an NPC to join the party, why do you stay on with the party after the contract is complete?
I mean, there's got to be some sort of change of heart or change of loyalty, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it would be important if you're playing a character like this that you have a secondary motivation that you give to the GM.
A personal motivation.
Right, pull you along with the party. Something that it'll be a little bit of a dereliction of duty. This is your last contract kind of thing.
I feel like a character that's so lawful, I would want it to be almost illogical, like love.
Oh, that's a good one. Or revenge would be fitting as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps the law has failed him.
I think I'm the optimist and you're the pessimist, huh?
Mm, perhaps.
I'm Serena and you're Venus. Does that still work now? That's the only one I know.
I tune in next week to see if Ishan has learned another sports ball metaphor.
Nope.
Spoiler, he doesn't. So before we get off the subject of judgment, if you'd like to judge us, you can find us on iTunes. And if you judge us favorably, say with a 5-star review, we'll read it on the air. You can also judge us on Stitcher by giving us a thumbs up or a plus. Stitcher's like the Pandora of podcasts. So by doing that, you're telling their algorithm to bring you more great content like us. And that'll help other people find our show.
You know, we've had a few people who've already done that.
Yeah. So I should add a caveat. At some point in every podcaster's career, they run into this problem. iTunes is completely siloed by country. So this review actually is from back in August, and I just found out that we had it. So I am sorry for the delay and for not keeping our promise for like 9 weeks, but I will read this review now. This is All Thriller, No Filler by R. Tassiker. The newest addition to my D&D podcast schedule, Sean and Nishan join a relaxed and professional style with a level of 5th ed experience and system mastery I haven't heard from anyone else. Great audio production to boot. Give them a listen.
My favorite part about that is that he got my name right. Because that's rare.
And my name wrong?
I mean, who cares about
you? Are you delighting in my suffering right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all right. I've been called Sean like my whole life.
Me too.
Well, what do we have planned for next episode, Ishan?
We'll be talking about improvisation.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We'll be building a Warhammer 40K Inquisitor, which means we'll be improving on brand.
Yeah, not a filthy radical Inquisitor-like brand. A good, proper, human, puritanical Inquisitor.
Yeah, no filthy Xenos like brand.
He's a half-elf.
Yeah, exactly.
Half Xenos.
that's the worst.
That's too much Xenos for anybody. Well, that's it for episode 11 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.